would feel to be free. And we
greetings. I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central, right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central, 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday, right here on KPFK.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're tuned to 90.7 FM KPFK, radio powered by the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace!
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. 2 weeks ago on this program, we featured an interview with the well-known Russian Marxist Boris Kagarlitsky after his release from nearly 5 months in prison for a baseless and far-fetched charge of justifying terrorism, for ironic remarks he made on his social media channel after the explosion on the Crimean Bridge in 2022. He was freed after a military court handed him a fine in December. But then in February 2024, there was an unexpected appeal trial at a military court of appeals where the prosecutors overturned the December verdict that freed him, citing excessive leniency. Kagarlitsky was sentenced to 5 years in a general regime penal colony and whisked from the courtroom to prison. He is now serving his sentence in a penal colony in Torzhok, 155 miles northwest of Moscow. We rebroadcast that interview before his final appeal on June 5th to raise awareness, build solidarity and pressure, and to encourage people to sign the Free Boris petition. Now, on June 5th, Russia's Supreme Court, that was last Wednesday, upheld a 5-year prison sentence against Kagarlitsky, meaning that he will now remain confined in the penal colony in Torzhok. During that appeal, Kagarlitsky said, naming the offending YouTube video, which was called Explosive Congratulations for Mustik the Cat, which was a reference to a real cat that lived on the Crimea Bridge, was, quote, an unfortunate joke. However, he argued that his jail time was disproportionate to the offense. Kagarlitsky's attorney, Sergei Yerakov, plans to appeal the verdict with Russia's constitutional court on the grounds that his client received excessive punishment. Ilya Budryatskis, a longtime Russian leftist and anti-war critic who had to leave Russia after the invasion of Ukraine, joins us today to help us understand this verdict, the case, the scope and nature of repression in Russia, and the chances for Kagarlitsky to go free. We'll also ask for your support when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Boris Kagarlitsky's appeal against a 5-year jail term for justifying terrorism was rejected by the Supreme Court of the Russian Federation, meaning that he will now remain confined in a penal colony in Torzhok. The verdict was unjust, but not unexpected. The judge's draconian decision was no great surprise, since all recent appeals against sentences brought down under Russia's catch-all anti-terrorism legislation have been rejected. The baseless charge of justifying terrorism has been widely used against anti-war activists in the Russian Federation and was brought against Kagarlitsky last summer for ironic remarks he made on his social media channel after the explosion on the Crimean Bridge in 2022. The case against Kagarlitsky is very indicative. People are put in jail for words, meaningless words. In Boris's case, a joke that didn't land. For 4 words, he received 5 years. The words refer to the title of a social media video, Explosive Congratulations for Mustik the Cat, an actual cat that lived on the bridge. Kagalitsky's lawyer argues that the punishment must correspond to the nature of the crime, the degree of danger it entails for the public, and the circumstances in which it is committed. The judge's cruel decision to ignore such basic legal criteria reflects the determination of the Putin regime to crush domestic opposition to its war in Ukraine. This is a regime and state bent on suppressing all forms of criticism, jokes included. In this context, the basic democratic and legal rights of anti-war activists like Boris Kagalitsky and thousands of others count for very little. Kagalitsky has been courageous and consistent in speaking out against the war in Ukraine since day one and is in prison because of this. He's the victim of a gross but entirely deliberate miscarriage of justice and has become a symbol for the struggle for the right to freedom of expression. In that regard, he's a prisoner of conscience and requires our support, as do all political prisoners. Ilya Budryatskis, another Putin critic who taught at the Moscow School of Social and Economic Sciences until spring of 2022, was dismissed from his job and forced to flee Russia to avoid arrest for his active critique of the war in Ukraine and consistent opposition to Putin's regime. He's joining us with his take on the fate of criticism in Russia and the case of Boris Kagalitsky in general. Ilya is back with us on Beneath the Surface, and I'm very pleased to have him. He's a political, cultural, and art theorist and activist, and one of the sharpest thinkers from Russia's post-Soviet generation. He joined UC Berkeley as a visiting scholar in 2023 after having to leave Russia for his war criticism and activism. His book, Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia, was published by Verso in 2022. He's the member of the editorial board of Postly Media, that means after, and he has his own Telegraph channel called Brave New World. He's working on a book with Ilya Mitveyev, and it's going to outline Putin's foreign policy and his invasion of Ukraine and so much else, and we're definitely going to talk to both of them when that book is published. Ilya, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a crazy week in terms of, let's call it, the demonstration of misjustice in Putin's Russia. Can you talk a little bit about the denial of the plea, the cassation plea, as they call it in Russia, or the appeal, and Boris's situation, Boris Kagalitsky's situation?
Yeah, so of course, as you mentioned, this decision of the higher court was predictable, because in Russia it's not a question of, let's say, legal arguments, but it's a question of political decision coming from the top administration of Russian president, particularly. The aim of a lawyer, the aim of the campaign in support of Boris was to convince not just the judge, but also, let's say, this hidden political force behind him, that Boris is ready to leave Russia, that there is no sense to have him in jail no more. And that's why the lawyer provided a number of invitations from the various universities, from the Global South, especially from Brazil and South Africa. So all these universities declared that they're happy to invite Boris as a lecturer. But unfortunately, it was not convincing enough for, let's say, Russian leadership. And that's why it happened. But it's not the last chance. So the Boris lawyer is going to apply for some higher instances, especially the Supreme Court of the Russian Federation. So it will happen quite soon in the coming months. And of course, we should follow this process, and we should keep supporting Boris in any possible way in these coming hearings.
What do you think, Ilya, of what it means for the regime to ignore international pressure? Now, of course, we saw it in the case of Navalny. There was probably a worldwide campaign, the likes of which have not been seen before. But Boris Kagalitsky is different than Navalny. He is a well-known international socialist, leftist, and he doesn't represent a threat to the actual regime's power in terms of, you know, possibly being a candidate to replace Putin in the way that Navalny was. But nonetheless, there was a pretty significant international campaign. And as you just mentioned, Boris was received offers to teach at joint appointment universities in Brazil and also in South Africa. And the lawyer had those letters from the rectors and presidents of the university to present to the court. In one instance, I think the court didn't want to accept it and said it was irrelevant. In any case, they did. So there's some ambivalence there, but it's really, you know, I wonder what you think of that, because as you just mentioned, these are offers from universities in the global South, in what we call the BRICS countries, and Putin generally needs the support of these countries. So is this a case in your understanding of how things go in Russia that the court pays no attention or pays total attention to the international politics? What's your take on that?
Mm-hmm. Firstly, even in this recent court, the judge, he openly said that the main reason why Boris was arrested is that he publicly opposed the war, he publicly criticized the war. That's the case for hundreds of political prisoners that you have now in Russia. So I think if you look at the criteria of the most of these political cases, like public criticism of what is going on in the country, of the war in Ukraine, Boris definitely fits this criteria. So he is a public figure. He publicly criticized the war, and usually such people, they are arrested, and most of these people, they're already in prison or they already left the country. So in this case, there is no any unique in the case of Kagarlitsky, unfortunately. And as for all this international support, so it's important to understand that for Putin regime in general, any sort of international support, like perceived as a sort of political pressure to the country, to its leadership. So that's why to reject any of this pressure is also a way to maintain the sovereignty, the true sovereignty of the country. That's why, unfortunately, these sort of international campaigns, they are not so much effective in the case of Russia. But I think you're quite right when you mentioned that the, let's say, public opinion or opinion of political elite of the BRICS countries are quite important for Putin. So that could work probably in some coming future as an argument, but not in the moment.
I want to go into two sort of different areas on this. And one is certainly Boris's case, and maybe we'll go into three areas. In fact, the other would be what happens to ordinary citizens who don't have his fame, and also then look at some of those cases. But in this case, it goes against what we think about how international pressure works, because generally, especially the kind of outside pressure that comes from the countries that Putin relies on for support in international arenas should matter. And I think it brings up the issue of the court in this instance. We should first say that most courts rubber stamp whatever, you know, whatever the decisions come from on high. But in this case, it kind of shows that they ignored it, even though you did say, Ilya, that there is the possibility of other appeals. And we will certainly talk about that. How does it work? What does it mean? What is this? What is the message that goes from this court in denying this kind of appeal on such an innocuous charge?
So do you mean what is the reason for this decision?
Yeah, and how would it be interpreted, you know, to other people, not just, let's say, people who don't pay any attention, but people who do pay attention and who are opposed to this regime?
You mean in Russia? Or
In Russia, of course.
So I think that the message of all repressions in Russia during last 3 years especially is quite clear that, look, these are the examples what could happen to any of you if you raise your voice against the war, if you will comment any political events, even in domestic politics, in the way that somehow differs from the official line. So I think the signal is pretty clear, and not only in this case, but in the hundreds of other cases. So maybe I will remind you some numbers. Starting from the beginning of the war, more than 900 criminal cases were open on the different criminal articles of the Russian Criminal Code, which have a clear political meaning. From this more than 900 cases, you can find almost 300 cases which devoted for so-called distribution of the fake news about Russian army. So that means that any information that is differs from the official information coming from the pro-government media could be considered as the fake. And you can go to prison up to 7 years for the distribution of such fake information. So the second popular, let's say, article for such cases is exactly Boris' article, The Justification of Terrorism. So for now, you have almost 160 cases like this in Russia opened in the last 2 years. And the reason why Boris was arrested not for distribution of fakes, but for justification of terrorism is unclear, because basically there are no any clear ground for any of these cases. But I think the reason why they accused him for justification of terrorism was that it was easier to prove than distribution of fakes. In his case, yes. So for example, he never talked about, I don't know, Bucha, for example, or things like this. So that's why they think, okay, we just found another commentary coming from Boris about this Crimean breach. So that could be a good case for justification of terrorism. It's also important to mention that the very nature of all these criminal cases could be considered as what was called in the Nazi Germany phenomenological, phenomenological character of law. So it means that you're accused for something not because of what you have done, not because of some exact words of exact actions, but because we know who you are. We know that you are a oppositioner. We know that you are critical to the so-called special military operation in Ukraine. That's why you should be arrested. That's why you should be in jail. And I think that was pretty clearly declared by the judge in this last hearing.
That explains a lot. And thank you so much for giving us the actual numbers. I did read or heard recently from, and I have the quote somewhere, that in fact, something like 116,000 people have been stopped and have been, you know, momentarily detained or threatened to be charged since the war began for making some kind of a statement. And it's just to give it the general impression, because what you've just done is to talk about the nature of the legal system when it actually has to go and prosecute these cases. But just in terms of the, you know, right at the very beginning of the war, there was a massive protest. There were demonstrations of 40,000. And since that time, this has simply escalated in terms of they've crushed the demonstrations, but they've stepped up the repression for showing any sort of support whatsoever for Ukraine's side or against the war. And I want to go into more of that, but I wanted to say that, you know, Boris himself wrote in an article very shortly after the war, before he was arrested, that people are charged for private conversations that are then declared to be public since they were overheard. He gave a case of someone inadvertently painting, having a fence that they painted years ago in the colors of yellow and blue. Those are the colors of the Ukrainian flag. People have been stopped for thoughtlessly wearing blue jeans with a yellow jacket, and meaning somehow that that is threatening and it looks like they're supporting Ukraine. And Kagalitsky wrote, "Try to imagine what it's like to live in a state where you can be detained and prosecuted for wearing the wrong clothes, for liking a seditious post on social networks, or simply because the incoming police chief did not like your appearance. As a matter of principle, Russian courts do not pass down acquittals. And in this regard, the situation is much worse than in Stalin time. So any accusation, even the most absurd, is considered proven as soon as it is brought. This applies not only to political matters, but to any case." Now, he wrote that before he was himself charged. And as you said, and as it, a lot of the case goes about these four careless words and this bad joke that he made. But you just explained that that isn't, you know, that's irrelevant. That might be the what they hang the case on, but it isn't just about those words. And so the merits of the case aren't discussed. It's as you've just said, they're trying to crush or to suppress, rather, all forms of criticism, even jokes. And so this is, you know, maybe you could just say a little bit more about that, because what does it mean in terms of action? And a follow-up question that I was going to ask you is that before you're arrested, if you're somebody prominent or you're an organization, they slap this term of foreign agent on you. I want to come back to that, but let me just get your sense, first of all, on the sort of random, even terrorizing of people in the streets for wearing the wrong color.
So if we look at the, let's say, the logic of political repressions in Russia starting from the beginning of the full-scale invasion, we can see that the aim of these repressions, like in the first year of the war, was very instrumental. So it was focused on oppression of any public protests. So if you are trying to protest publicly in a demonstration, in a picket line, you would be arrested for that, and probably you would be accused for discreditation of the Russian army or for the distribution of fakes or something like this. But then, I will say, starting from the last year, the logic changed. The first aim of repressions was reached, like it was realized. Let's say to the summer of 2022, there were no any public protests, no any anti-war mobilizations, even illegal, because it became clear for everyone what the consequences would be for this. And then, starting from the last year, the logic turned to a more systematic way of repressions that target every sort of political opposition, even hidden political opposition or oppositional sentiments in the country. I think in this sense, it could be more compared with the logic of Stalinist repressions. Yeah. Of course, the scale is still different because I can just...
12 million were detained under Stalin. Millions were killed. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the absurdity of the charges, you know, is very, very similar. And then the ripple effect that has on others.
The absurdity of the charges and also I will say, of behavior, police and especially federal security service, which are massively using tortures now. So it's not the only thing that you could be arrested, but you will be beaten, tortured, you will be humiliated. So that's a part of their usual practice. And there are a lot of cases of tortures during the investigations or tortures in detention prisons and so on. So in this way, I think the situation is quite comparable with Stalinist times, because there is no any restrictions for the use of violence coming from the state. That is definitely very scary. So if you are in prison, it doesn't mean that you are safe somehow. It means that you are in danger. And especially after the murder of Navalny, so I believe that it was a murder organized by the state in prison. So all the prison authorities, all the people in the secret services, in the police, they got a clear signal that these tortures, this violence in prisons, they are normalized. They should become a norm. Since the death of Navalny, some more and more new examples of this violence are coming from the Russian prisons.
You know, you mentioned earlier that if you do something so overt as criticize the absolutely barbaric assault on Bucha and the war crimes there, I think that's the case of his name?
Yashin, Ilya Yashin.
Yashin, he's a young guy who's also had his case overturned more or less at the same time as Boris. And now he's in prison for making remarks about that. And you're very right to mention the torture that's being used, or the green light, you know, to be able to torture opponents. And we're seeing, if for listeners, there are some very good sites that catalog all of this. OVD, it's those OVD is one of them. Media Zona is another. And probably, Ilya, can you give us a few more so that people can kind of track it and maybe join in on the international pressure and solidarity, try to make it harder for this to go on in real time? You know, maybe you could talk a little bit about a few other cases. But the other thing that, you know, I kind of wanted you to bring up is that not only is the repression swift and brutal and has consistently escalated each year of Putin's rule, essentially, but really markedly since, you know, the war on Ukraine. And we already talked a little bit about that. But the government has been slapping the label foreign agent on not just people, but organizations, or I should just say not just organizations, but people. Mm-hmm. And usually, I guess it means that an arrest is imminent or it's an invitation to leave the country. And Boris was named a foreign agent in 2022. Recently, the entire Russian left movement as an organization, right, was named a foreign agent. And one of the things I'd love for you to explain is what that really means. Like, of course, we see, if you, like me, read a lot, every time that somebody in the press will mention someone's name, they have to put a star and say foreign agent. What does that mean for the person or the organization that's labeled that, and for those who forget to say that that person is a foreign agent? What are the bureaucratic tasks associated with that label that must be, you know, fulfilled?
So the bureaucratic task of all this law, which is very expanded, because there could be not just individuals recognized as a foreign agents, but also mass media or organizations, or even non-existent organizations, like, for example, LGBT, international LGBT movement was recognized as a foreign agent. So that means that if you are using, I don't know, rainbow flag, you could be arrested or fined because you somehow affiliated with this foreign agent. Basically, the logic of this law is to provide some sort of civic death for the people who are not just recognized as a foreign agents personally, but who are affiliated with these foreign agents in any way. So also foreign agents are not allowed to teach in the public schools, to work in universities, to participate in any sort of elections, to be an observers on elections. So there are many, many different types of restrictions. And also this law is exactly working according to this phenomenological understanding of law that I already explained. So, for example, 2 days ago, the deputy of Minister of Justice of Russian Federation explained the reasons why LGBT international LGBT movement was recognized as a foreign agent. And he said that this movement was established in some early 80s, inspired by ideas of the gay nationalism and gender war. So the aim of this movement to organize gender war internationally, globally. So that's why this movement is extremist and should be banned on the territory of Russian Federation. So you can see that this explanation is, I don't know, it's unbelievable. It's fantastic.
But what it really says, though, is that any criticism whatsoever is labeled as foreign. That, in other words, if you're Russian, you're not capable of being critical. And if you are, you've been implanted with ideas from abroad, and therefore you're potentially a traitor to the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So if your point of view is different from the official line, so that means that you somehow influenced from abroad. So that is the main idea behind this law. Yeah.
It's crazy because, you know, we mentioned that there's a lot of Stalin-esque kind of characteristics to this, but this seems to me to be, you could say, maybe more sophisticated, but also broader. Stalin didn't do anything like that. He certainly had a lot of epithets for his enemies and called them agents of, you know, this and that, security service from abroad, the Gestapo, the OVRA, the Japanese security, all of that. But he didn't have a broad characterization, I don't think, you know, of something foreign agent for anyone who's critical. So maybe this is a 21st century.
Yeah. So definitely Stalin had his very perverted class analysis behind it. So the people who are the enemies of the Soviet people, they somehow serve the other class interests, the interests of the workers and peasants. So here now in Russia, definitely you have the different logic, and this logic related to the ideology. The official ideology of Putin's Russia, which is extremely reactionary, conservative, and nationalist in a way that it based on the idea of some kind of organic unity of the Russian people. So if something question this unity, something doubt this unity, that means that it served the interest of some geopolitical rivals of Russian Federation. So that is the logic. Yeah,
that's the clearest explanation I've ever had. Thank you for that, Ilya Budryatskis. But then, you know, there's this other aspect of the way that it's being used. So I just mentioned that the Russian left socialist movement was labeled a foreign agent. So it paralyzes any form of activity. You know, it makes it very difficult for them to operate apart from the ideological considerations of why they were named. That's obvious. But it also means it can be very effective, right, in stopping people from doing anything.
Absolutely, especially if you are living in Russia and you're planning to live and work in the country, so it makes your life very hard. Not even if you are recognized personally as the foreign agent, but also if you're affiliated with the foreign agent in any way. And the Russian Ministry of Justice has another list of the people who are affiliated with the foreign agents. And this list is much bigger than the foreign agents. For example, now in Russia, you have almost 800 foreign agents. Together, individuals, organizations, media, and so on. Probably you have some thousands in this list of the people who are affiliated to these organizations, and this list is not public. So we can only speculate of what names could be found in this list.
Pretty incredible, and I'm glad you brought that up. But there's also this one other aspect of it, and that is that, you know, Boris Kagarlitsky was slapped with the label foreign agent in 2022. And he continued. He continued to run Robcore, the social media channel, and his popular YouTube program. He continued to write articles, and he simply, you know, put on the tag of the name foreign agent. But once he was arrested last summer and then spent, you know, 4.5 months in pretrial detention and then was freed, he's been criticized because people say, well, when he was freed and he was still a foreign agent, that was a sign that he must leave Russia. And the fact that he didn't leave and was then his conviction was overturned and he's now in prison for 5 years. People are blaming him for that and saying he made a terrible mistake. He should have left. And you could then say Navalny made a terrible mistake coming back to Russia thinking he could do something. The message is that you can't do it. But Grigory Yudin, who's a friend and colleague of yours, says that this is a form of victim blaming, that, you know, instead of saying, what right does the state have to do this to individuals? We're now putting the onus on the individual for his decision. In this case, Boris wanted to stay and fight. Russia's his country. Why shouldn't he be able to do that? Why shouldn't he be able to, if not fight, at least stay, exist, and continue his work?
Yeah, absolutely. Because that is the victim blaming perspective that basically came from the Russian officials. Boris' trail probably was like that, okay, we gave him a chance to leave. He denied this chance. So now he's in prison again, but it's the consequences of his own decision. So he is the only one to be blamed for this. So that is the logic in Russia for the moment. But of course, it's very hard to discuss the various reasons for decisions of every person. You know, I don't know, maybe Navalny, who decided to come back to Russia in the early 2021. So he didn't expect that Russia became a quite different country in a year. Yeah, so maybe a year later, his decision could be different. And that also could be a case of Kagarlitsky. So probably his expectations coming from his understanding of the domestic political situation of Russia in Russia was different than to what happened in reality.
I want us to kind of turn now to talking about what this all means. You started to talk about the ideology of Putin. We keep talking about Putin rather than the sort of ruling group as it exists, because it seems like everything comes down to the decision of one man. I don't know if that's the case, but it seems like he's the only person that hands down decisions politically about who's allowed to be treated with leniency and who's not. In this case, you know, Kagarlitsky, Putin is certainly aware of him. And there was a press conference, the Valdai Club, in which Radhika Desai brought up the case of Boris. There have been statements by Lula, Corbyn, lots of different, you know, foreign leaders that have made it a case, so he can't ignore it, and yet he is ignoring it. So what we're saying is it's international pressure is important, but it, in this case, hasn't yet worked. But I really want to ask you what it means for a regime to exist like that. You just said, Ilya, that had Navalny understood in 2021 how much Russia had changed, maybe he would have reconsidered his tactic for how he would use his opposition. And it seems like every year that Putin is in power, he's very different. I wanted to say, Isaac Deutscher once said that had Stalin in 1924 understood what he would be doing in 1936, he might have committed suicide. I doubt that very much, that he would have committed suicide. But on the other hand, it isn't the personality of a man, but the kind of power and the logic of the situation leads to increased repression that then gets out of control. And it seems to me in that way, there's a huge similarity, that given Putin's grip on power and his need to be in power, he's increased repression. And there is a logic at work here. But what does it say about the regime in your view? And does it reveal an inner weakness of the regime or maybe a threat to its stability and longevity?
You know, we already talked about this difference between the scale of the repressions
yes. and
during the Great Terror in Stalin times and nowadays in Russia. And I think that what was clear even for Stalin, that you can't combine this scale of repressions with the ongoing war. There are many things were written how the this massive repressions, especially against the military in the late 30s, how they weaken the Red Army in the Second World War. That is quite clear for Putin, and if he's planning to continue the war, he perfectly understand that the repressions should be limited in some way. They should be very reasonable in the way to keep the certain atmosphere of fear and obedience in the country, but not come to some extra scale, extra numbers and so on, which definitely provides some sort of autonomy of the repressive apparatus from Putin himself. That's why I don't think that he's planning to organize some sort of Great Terror too. Like in some coming years. But what is clear that the start of the war marked the turn in the very character of regime, and now it became like repressive on its nature, let's say. So now repressions became a part of the usual behavior of the state towards society. So that's why I think that the repressions will increase by numbers, but this increase, quantitative. So it could not look like as, okay, now we will start a huge campaign against the foreign agents. We will arrest, tens of thousands of people and put them in concentration camps. So I think that decisions like this could be, so it could destabilize the regime and Kremlin perfectly understand it.
How do you see this in terms of other aspects of what the war has done and why Putin has gone to war? Because it's, as you're explaining, Ilya, it's had a lot of consequences that were probably not thought of when he made that mistake. We've talked about this before. The decision to go to war seemed crazy and wrong and impulsive, but now there's a logic once you're in war. And in terms of the repression and the lack of manpower to fight the war, Putin's also used prisoners. And there was one case where it was an older man, and I don't remember his name, but he was given the opportunity to go. He could leave prison if he went to fight on Russia's side in Ukraine, which essentially is a death sentence. There seems to be like a contradiction in there somewhere. But this gives us the opportunity, I think, in the last part of our show for you to talk about the character of the regime, the war, and what it means for the polity, for its economy, its standing in the world, its perhaps coming dependence on China, all of that. Sorry to give you such a huge question.
Yeah. So if we look at this relations between the government and society in Russia and the tasks of the regime in this war, it become pretty clear that there is a certain contradiction in the strategy of the domestic politics. So on one side, the government is trying to bring this state ideology to the society in the way that people should be really mobilized by the ideas behind this war. They should take Putin's ideas about this war as their personal beliefs. And that is the clear strategy that you see on one side. But on the other side, you can see that the regime is still interested in maintaining this state of, or this feeling of stability. That, okay, we have a special military operation, we have the confrontation with half of the world, but things are going fine. The Russian economy is growing, there are more opportunities to come. Russia became like first economy in Europe, according to last statement of Vladimir Putin. So he is trying to combine this idea of the rally around the flag and the idea of the business as usual for the people inside the country. And this is a kind of very controversial message by its nature, but paradoxically, it's working, and I think it's working because of this very deep neoliberal rationality in the Russian society in general, because Russian society was radically transformed in the previous decades, starting from the early 90s, and the main result of this transformation was the spread of cynicism and destruction of various feelings of social solidarity. That sort of atomized, highly atomized society became a, let's say, fundament for Putin's regime over the decades, and he's trying to keep this this feeling, this state of the society, but to introduce this society into his nationalist imperialist ideology in the same time. That's the way how it is for now, and that is why you have this kind of declarations of high level of patriotism in the Russian society, that there are thousands and thousands of people who are coming voluntarily to serve in the army to fight fascism as their grandfathers during the Second World War. And at the same time, huge money that, yes, that are proposed for any of these volunteers, and this very clear understanding in the broad layers of the society that the people are fighting there because of this money, because these patriotic feelings are definitely not enough. This should be supported with some serious amount of money.
Is that also the case when they're recruited from prison? Are they also paid well to...
No, they're recruited from prison because it's the existential question for Russian prisoners. So Russian prison is hell on the earth, and that's why even the death in the front line is better than the kind of survival, terrible survival in the Russian prisons, and that give actually a good understanding of what Russian prison system is about, then right. Then people massively ready to go even to the war where they could die than to stay in the prison.
Is there not, though, a contradiction in a way for this extreme neoliberal practice, let's say, of the regime in Russia, or the direction of the state, say, investment in now military production to support the war, and also state-directed ideology, not of individualism and privatization and all the other things, but of patriotism and do your duty for Mother Russia and fighting fascism? It just seems to me like there's a giant contradiction, but is it apparent?
It's very interesting, and it could provide us a lot of material to talk about the dominating political discourse in Russia. But, for example, in the various public statements of Russian officials, you can find this idea that the war or confrontation with the West is value-based. That is the clash of the various moral, let's say, systems. And what is wrong with the Western moral system is that it's based on individualism. while the Russian moral system based on collectivism. And it's very interesting how this idea of collectivism combined with the state of society, with no any sense of social solidarity, with this political indifference, fear, atomization, and so on. And I think that the answer would be that when the Russian officials talking about individualism as the wrong Western value, they are talking about the idea of individual rights, but not the idea of individual interests. So the individual interests, they're fine. It's natural, you know. All the people serve their own interests, so it's as natural as the market relations. But the idea of individual rights is wrong because it limits the sovereignty of the state. It's dubbed the right of the state to interpret the law in any way that serve the interests of the state. So that's why individualism in this kind of ideological framework means that any sort of individual rights, so basic democratic rights, your right to have a different opinion, right to assembly, right for public expression of your views, and so on.
Incredible. And you've just, you know, marked another strong parallel with the Stalin regime, even though the ideology was completely different. But you could say Stalin, of course, pretended that his was a socialist slash communist regime and was the complete contradiction of that. But what he did use is this form of collectivism in the same sense. You collectively have to obey what I say. You know, you don't have the right to criticize. But in that interest, you also couldn't organize in any way, for example, even to start your own business or service. Of course, there's a difference. Ilya, we don't have any more time on this, but it's a very suggestive area that I want to come back to explore with you because it tells us a lot about Russia. We didn't really get into Russia in the world today, and we did begin with the case of Boris Kagarlitsky. And, you know, I'd like to go out with the sense that there still is a use and an importance for international solidarity and for international pressure. Maybe you could just finish up by saying why this is or is not fruitful, useful, and important.
So it's extremely useful and extremely important, also in the sense of international campaign against the political repressions in general in Russia, because you have to understand that these people who are protesting against the war or against the social inequality or against the repressive state regime, they are a part of the, let's say, global movement. If you are pose yourself on the left, on the progressive side, there are your comrades, let's say, in struggle. And this struggle is international struggle. And I think it's a duty, you know, to support the people who are struggling for the same things as you in your country. In a quite different situation, which now is much better than in Russia, but could easily move to the authoritarian direction. And I think that Russian case should also be taken as a warning, as a global warning of what could happen with you. Especially in the case of Boris Kagarlitsky is important because figure of Kagarlitsky is definitely emblematic for the Russian left and for the international left. So in this sense, his case is decisive not only for him but also for other left-wing socialist political prisoners in Russia.
Thank you so much for all of that. And just to the listeners, go look at freeboris.info to learn more about this. Maybe sign your name and do whatever you can. We have to speak out against this repression. Ilya, thanks for being with us on the program. As you can probably tell, he's a political, cultural, art theorist and activist, and has just proven that he is indeed one of the sharpest thinkers of the generation that came after the Soviet Union in Russia. He's now at UC Berkeley as a visiting scholar because he was forced to leave Russia for his activism and his critique of the war. the silver lining of that is we get to talk to him. Ilya's book is Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia, published by Verso in 2022. And you can look at Brave New World on Telegram or at Postly, P-O-S-L-E dot media to find other articles and thoughts that are expressed, many other places where he also writes. Thanks so much for joining us today, Ilya.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank my guest, Ilya Budryatskis. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, with editing and engineering help from Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on our program and guests are on our Facebook page, Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and please call 818-985-5735 to pledge your support to keep this program and radio station on the air. Stay tuned. I'm Susie Wiseman.
And thank you, Susie. And we look forward to Susie coming back next Sunday at 10 a.m. with another edition of Beneath the Surface, right here at 90.7 FM, KPFK, Los Angeles. And thank you, Susie, for inviting listeners to call in to support this kind of programming here at 90.7, 818-985-5735, and select option 2 to pledge your support, make a donation to keep KPFK on the air, keep this tradition of listener-sponsored radio going. We are in our fund drive, although it may seem it's a bit more of a laid-back fund drive than typically, but we are focused on bringing you lots of information that you'll find useful in your life and understanding the world and how you're going to comport yourself in it. Beneath the Surface is among a panoply of programs presenting all kinds of views and information that you're not likely to find on broadcast anywhere else. And it can take a lot of digging around on the web if you want to find that kind of information. So we present it to you here at 90.7 FM, 24/7 here in Los Angeles. And again, donations are what keeps us going directly from the listeners, and a convenient way to do that, again, call 818-985-5735, select option 2. A $25 pledge is the minimum to make yourself a voting member in the Pacifica Foundation, but certainly we invite donations of all sizes, $25, $250, $25,000. Hey, you know, if you have won the lottery lately and you're looking to dispense some of that cash, you can certainly throw it our way. We'll put it to good use. My name is Terry Guy, by the way. I work in the membership department here at KPFK, and I thank everyone who supports us, because I wouldn't be getting paid myself without that support. And certainly the donations pay for all kinds of things here at KPFK. We've had to expend a significant amount just getting set up in a new location in Glendale, while the historic KPFK building in North Hollywood is being purchased and will be refurbished. And we look forward to returning to that to occupy a portion of it within a few years. In the meantime, we are in studios in Glendale that are significantly different. And again, it's made possible. You know, it did involve a bit of cost and a lot of volunteer labor. And we certainly salute the volunteers who've helped bring us to this point. 818-985-5735, extension 2 or option 2. You can also go online at kpfk.org and click donate. You can see various thank you gifts that are available that you can get as a bonus for your donations to KPFK, such as a KPFK grocery tote bag for $50. We have a collectible Shepherd Fairey anniversary poster that was produced for KPFK's 60th anniversary a few years ago. That's available for a donation of $65 as KPFK goes into its 65th year of broadcasting. We'll be going to, coming up is the Sunday brunch edition of Cut to the Chase with Sylvester Rivers and Ife J, and that's coming from a special remote event today. So we invite you to stay tuned for that, certainly. And there's all kinds of other public affairs programming coming up. We'll be tuning in. We'll be presenting Middle East in Focus at 1, the Ralph Nader hour will be coming up at noon, followed by